Good morning. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 9.5 minutes past 8 o'clock on this Thursday, January the 31st. Good to have you with us and hope you join in as we talk about black conservatism this hour and why the number of African Americans who are politically conservative is growing while the number of blacks who self-identify as liberal has declined. Why? What's up with that? And is this good or bad for the black community or for all of us, for that matter? Our guest has researched the issue for his new book, Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. And we welcome your thoughts and questions for him at 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email to talk@wpr.org. Are black conservatives saviors or sellouts? Christopher Allen Bracey is a professor of law and of African American studies at Washington University. He is the author of Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. He joins us by telephone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks very much for being with us, and I understand there was a little bit of a miscommunication over how long this interview would be. I appreciate you taking the time to do the full hour with us.
Oh, it'll be a pleasure.
Anyway, you are a self-described liberal black, is that right?
Well, I'm a liberal, I have no problems identifying openly as a liberal and as a progressive. So I'm coming at this topic from a slightly different perspective. I mean, this is not one of those polemical texts written by a conservative. It's more of a serious question raised by a liberal who wants to understand, number one, what is a black conservative? And number two, why would anyone choose to become one?
Yeah, and you, there's more than one answer to your question, but what is a black conservative?
Well, you know, that's the thing. It's not nearly as simple as you would think. These political dividing lines are never as crisply defined as we'd like them to be. And as I began to sort of probe this question, it occurred to me that what it means to be a conservative actually is a sort of an organic thing. It takes shape over time and against the backdrop of prevailing social, political, and economic realities. And so the point is that for each generation, being a conservative means something different. And so it's a moving target, if you will. And so the story that begins to develop is one that's really interesting because what it meant to be a conservative in the 19th century in reaction to oppressive political subordination by prevailing white society gets transformed into the modern neoconservatism that defines black conservatives today, like a Clarence Thomas or Shelby Steele or John McWhorter, something very different than it was in the 19th century.
Yeah, you obviously talk about in the book that this is nothing new. You want to talk about the history of black conservatism?
Yeah. I mean, the most important thing to appreciate, at least from my perspective coming in, was that most liberals, when they think of black conservatives, think of them as a largely fabricated and new constituency, new on the political scene, without a lot of political clout, and so they can be largely ignored when it comes to matter of public discourse and public debate. But as I began to dig a little bit more deeply, I realized that black conservatism actually was the dominant political philosophy for African Americans since the founding of the Republic, and that it was only in the 20th century where we really begin to see a resurgence of liberal progressive thought among African Americans, and even then it's sort of touch and go. You know, these political ideologies have life cycles, they ebb and flow. And so, you know, it occurred to me that, you know, we need to give a certain amount of respect to black conservatism as a mode of political thought, but we also ought to give respect to the leaders that espouse these conservative ideas, because for them it was a dramatic exercise in human agency, and it was a dramatic exercise developing a political philosophy that would ensure the longevity of a people.
Yeah, speaking of ebbing and flowing, talk some about the where it stands right now. You state that conservatives, the number of conservatives, black conservatives, is growing, and those who say they're liberal or progressive is declining?
Yes. I mean, you know, you look at the numbers from, you know, trends for the last 30 or 40 years, and the number of blacks who self-identify as conservative is indeed growing. You know, in 1972, about 10% or maybe 9% of blacks identified as conservative. Today, nearly 30% or 11.2 million people, African Americans, self-identify as conservative. Now, this doesn't mean that they are registered Republicans or that they identify with the Republican platform. It just means that their politics, they view their politics as somewhat conservative. You look at the 2006 voting referendum in Virginia on same-sex marriage. 56% of black voters supported a ban on same-sex marriage in Virginia. Mm. All right, so there is a sort of latent conservatism within black politics. The important thing to realize is that it doesn't map on neatly to our prevailing sort of spectrum of Republican and Democratic ideology. It is a much more complicated tale, and that's what gets teased out in the book.
Yeah, and yeah, talk some about that. When someone is a self-identified conservative black, is that mainly just on social issues, or it's much more than that?
Well, you know, it's a complicated mix. I mean, you know, what it means usually, because, you know, when you think about black conservatism, turns out that black conservatism is rooted in a Christian evangelical tradition. And so you're right, there's this element of social conservatism that is dominant in the early period, you know, sort of leading a morally chaste lifestyle, temperate lifestyle, you know, allegiance to God, eschewing rebelliousness, that sort of thing. But that gets transformed into a sort of entrepreneurial moralism, where blacks begin to develop a political philosophy that's grounded in making economic progress and producing economic stability, not brushing institutions of society against the grain, understanding that there are real constraints on one's ability to flourish in American society, but nonetheless retaining a pragmatic optimism. Then that gets transformed into a more sort of, I would say, almost nationalistic approach to racial empowerment. Being conservative is the ability to identify oneself, to self-identify, and not be defined by external forces. It is the ability to lead a self-directed life with dignity and respect, becoming reliant and individualistic in one's outlook. And so that takes us through roughly the 1970s, close to 1980, and then there's this dramatic transformation that occurs when, you know, I argue that a lot of what we think of as traditional black conservative thought gets co-opted by white conservative elites. And that's really where you see the break between traditional black conservatives and modern neoconservatives like the Clarence Thomases, the Thomas Sowells, the Shelby Steeles, and so on and so forth. Those guys are a different breed. They come from a different stock, and they also have a different organic backing, whereas traditional black conservatives were rooted and found their strength in the black community. Modern black conservatives tend to be supported by white conservative think tanks, white elites. They don't have that natural organic black constituency.
Talk a little bit more about that. How have the white elites co-opted the new black conservative?
Well, okay, so in 1980, when President Reagan was about to become president, he was about to be inaugurated, there was a conference held in San Francisco called the Fairmont Conference at the Fairmont Hotel. And it was organized by Ed Meese, who was head of Reagan's transition team, and the purpose of the conference was to identify a cohort of young black leaders who could replace the civil rights establishment and would support the Reagan agenda for civil rights as opposed to constantly opposing the Reagan agenda for civil rights. And it was during this conference where names like Clarence Thomas, Clarence Pendleton, Glenn Lowry, Thomas Sowell, right, Alan Keyes, it was during this conference where those people who were in attendance first get recognized by the Reagan administration, declare their bona fides with conservative racial policy, and in exchange for making their deal with Ed Meese at that conference, many of them were rewarded with government positions, with positions in think tanks, but more importantly, they were given access to mainstream media. And so they became the dominant voice in the 80s and in the early 90s. These neoconservatives that were largely handpicked become the dominant voice of black political ideology.
So what about Condoleezza Rice?
So Condi is sort of enigmatic. And, you know, in the later chapters of the book where I talk about Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and Clarence Thomas, Condoleezza Rice comes off as the most enigmatic, I mean, the most mysterious of modern black conservatives. But even there, the story is complex because we'd like to think of Condoleezza Rice as an ideologue, as someone who is towing the Bush party line, the Bush administration line. And it turns out that this woman who was born and raised in Birmingham, Alabama, has a pretty good sense of herself as a black woman. And her politics don't fit neatly into the traditional Republican box. For instance, she's in favor and supports affirmative action.
We're going to take a short pause and then welcome calls for Christopher Allen Bracey. Christopher Bracey, a professor of law and of African and African-American studies at Washington University in St. Louis, author of the new book, Saviors or Sellouts, The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. Saviors or Sellouts, 1-800-642-1234, in Madison, 263-1890, or send an email with your question or comment to talk@wpr.org. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine, hoping you'll stay tuned. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn after 9 o'clock, talking with his guests about... Is the overproduction and overconsumption of meat harming us and the planet? Well, her guests say yes after 9 o'clock. One of them is Mark Bittman, who you may know of as the author of a lot of cookbooks, including How to Cook Everything Vegetarian. That's coming up after 9 o'clock. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn. We're talking about black conservatives. And whether they are saviors or sellouts, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Our guest, Christopher Bracey, is the author of the book, Saviors or Sellouts. And did you come up with an answer to that question, Professor Bracey, saviors or sellouts?
I guess you could think of the book as being an answer. The entire book represents an answer that suggests that the story is just complex. So are they saviors or sellouts? Turns out a little bit of both, right? Mm-hmm. You know, I think the dominant theme that one comes away with is the sense that black conservatives were doing a great deal to ensure the stability, the economic stability and longevity of the black community in very difficult times. I mean, Booker T. Washington being a prime example of that. There were other episodes in which conservative thought provided black people with a way of defining themselves against an oppressive society, a sort of way in which to forge an identity in a society in which people were seeking to deny you one or impose one on you. And so those components of black conservative thought suggest that many of the individuals who espoused these ideas were indeed saviors to the community. But at the same time, you know, black conservatives failed to realize that without a strong progressive agenda supporting civil rights, for instance, without taking societal institutions head on and challenging the orthodox view of where blacks should be in American society, without doing those sorts of things, all of the economic stability, all of the so-called empowerment that they were achieving ended up being precarious and precariously positioned. Couldn't be fully enjoyed. And so by leaving out the liberal component of law reform, they failed to realize that whatever accomplishments they were achieving would be fleeting. They would be temporary at best, and that these were gains that could be summarily taken away. And we saw that retrenchment occur following Reconstruction in the heyday of black conservatism in the early part of the 20th century with the rise and expansion of Jim Crow, radical lynching and violence perpetrated against black segregation in every aspect of public life. So the point is that they were neither saviors nor sellouts, but they are perhaps the most important overlooked contributors to African-American history, and they deserve to be recognized as such.
Yeah, and you say it's important to and relevant to look at this this issue today.
Absolutely. It's not just an historical phenomenon, precisely because the number of people who are self-identifying as black conservative is growing. And so for those of us who are serious about engaging in a politics of progressive empowerment for people of color and poor people in this country, we have to come to terms with the fact that we are negotiating strategies for empowerment with people who don't necessarily agree with us politically or ideologically, but that they are a relevant constituency and that we can no longer ignore them. We can't afford to ignore the sort of conservative take on many of these issues, because the reality is that the most prominent people in public office today who are African American are conservative. The leading public voices, intellectual voices in America that are African American, are conservative voices. Look at Bill Cosby and Chris Rock, you know, comedians, entertainers who are engaging in this infotainment sector of trying to raise the consciousness of the American people through their art forms are taking on a strikingly conservative valence in their discourse, right? And so it's up to us as progressives, if we really do care about engaging the substantive issues in a serious way and helping the African-American community and communities of color and poor people move forward and flourish in this American society, we've got to take these folks seriously.
To the phones we go. Ken in Louisville, Kentucky, I guess. Are you listening on the web, Ken?
No, I'm not. Basically, I'm traveling down the highway.
I get it. Okay.
One of the comments that I want to make and ask the good professor to kind of weigh in on it, one thing that I get from black conservatives is the thought that they're trying to provoke is race doesn't matter. Now, in South Carolina, basically with Obama's win in South Carolina, a lot of people were chanting, race doesn't matter. But, you know, and that kind of didn't sit well with me. The next day, I heard Tavis Smiley talk about he and Dr. West were basically discussing this question of whether or not race matters. And they were like me, race always matters. So, you know, basically I think a lot of black conservatives want us to buy into this thought that race doesn't matter, you know, and that it's somewhat that the playing field is now level. And that's it. I'm going to leave it alone. Professor, you went to a fine university in Washington U in St. Louis. My brother earned a PhD from there back in the 70s.
Ken, thank you very much for the call. So are black conservatives those that push the idea that race doesn't matter, Professor Bracey?
Well, you know, the story is more complicated than that, right? I mean, there are certain members of sort of the black conservative cohort, particularly the modern neoconservative cohort, who do argue that race should not matter. Very few, if any, black conservatives say that it doesn't matter. What they say is that it shouldn't matter and that we should strive to achieve a society in which race does become secondary or irrelevant. Clarence Thomas, in particular, is fond of sort of making that fine distinction. He says, you know, I understand that I'm a black man, but I'm a man first. And so what you find is that, you know, black conservatives want to suggest that they are human beings first, that their race is secondary and largely irrelevant for purposes of public life. But then you have people like Colin Powell and Condoleezza Rice that understand that their race is a constituent element of who they are. And that it's part of their identity, and they're proud to identify as black. You know, Colin Powell was deeply moved on his trip to West Africa, and he cried when he visited the slave castles. And he said, you know, now I think I've finally figured out, you know, what it really means. You know, what it means to be, you know, an African American. And this is Jamaican born Colin Powell, right? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sort of. So, and Condoleezza Rice, same way. I mean, she understands that, you know, part of who she is was forged in those difficult years in Birmingham, Alabama, experiencing the bombings and so on and so forth. And during her formative years in Denver, you know, hanging out with the likes of Stokely Carmichael. You know, these are things that people don't know about Condoleezza Rice, but you know, she deeply identifies as a black woman. So not all conservatives are pushing that same agenda, but Ken is right. I mean, there is this element within conservative thought, modern conservative thought, at least among the intellectuals, that we should try to get away from race and that we ought not. We ought not take race as an important value in defining ourselves, but that's new. Traditional black conservatives always understood that race was an important cultural component to being an African American. From Booker T. Washington, who wanted to establish black-run institutions precisely because we wouldn't be, he said in his own words, we wouldn't be held to, you know, held to the standards of white society if we could run our own institutions. We wouldn't be constrained in the way that white society constrains us if we run our own institutions. The Black Power movement, a conservative movement, I argue, in some critical respects, focused on self-identification as black and redefining what that means for everybody else.
Yeah, since Ken brought up South Carolina and the presidential race and all the talk about race going on there, what do you make of Barack Obama garnering, I think it was 80% of the African-American vote in South Carolina? So the progressive candidate got 80% of the African-American vote in that state.
Right. I mean, it's a remarkable thing. You know, Barack Obama has done a remarkable job of actually earning the black vote. You might recall, and I've blogged about this on my blog, www.blackprof.com, where, you know, Barack Obama was treated with skepticism when he entered this race. Remember, people were asking, was he black enough? Mm-hmm. His father African, his mother white. Is biracial black enough? Where is politics? You know, we don't know enough from Barack Obama. He needs to come talk to us. That sort of discourse. Dr. West, who endorsed my book, was skeptical of Barack Obama early on, wanted to hear more from Barack. But over the months, Barack Obama earned the respect and the votes of black voters, not just in South Carolina, but across the nation. But in South Carolina in particular, you know, blacks voted for him 4-1 over Hillary. Mm-hmm. And you have to ask yourself, what's that all about? I do think you know, the black voters in South Carolina are more sophisticated than we gave them credit. It was not simply a situation where they were deeply skeptical, because that's the posture that Southerners take to outsiders who are coming in, particularly from the North, agitating. Or it wasn't simply a genuflection when the ballot boxes are opened, where black people reflexively vote for the black candidate. I don't think either one of those narratives is accurate. I do think that a number of black voters, in particular black women, began to take seriously the idea that Barack Obama's time is now, and that his positions on issues are strong and helpful to the black community. But there was this other strand that's worth spinning out here, and I've seen this a couple of times in the exit polls. There were some black voters, black women voters, who were torn between Hillary and Barack, and ultimately they decided to vote for Barack, influenced in part from a decidedly conservative view, which is that when it comes down to it, they had a strong preference for a leader that was male.
Oh, yeah. Eric in New Glarus is with us now. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for enjoying your show today. I had read an article, and I don't remember where it was, but it had asked the question whether or not Martin Luther King was not even conservative or liberal, but Republican or Democrat. And the answer in the article was that he would have been a staunch Republican in today's society, and I'm wondering what your guest thinks about that.
That's a great question, and you know, it's the kind of question that, you know, actually a couple of us have debated over the years with respect to Martin Luther King and with respect to Malcolm X and a number of other prominent black leaders. Would they be registered Republicans or supporting the Republican Party or conservatives or liberal? You know, Martin Luther King was enigmatic, and, you know, his legacy has been distorted and twisted by both political sides for strategic advantage and leverage within the black community. There have been a number of Republicans that have claimed that you know, Martin Luther King was a colorblind advocate, you know, content of our character, not the color of our skin, right? And so his politics was one that's more consistent with the prevailing Republican ideology of colorblindness, where race shouldn't matter, and so we shouldn't be, for example, engaging in affirmative action and those sorts of things, and that it's, we should be instead engaged in a politics of equal opportunity for everyone, and that seems to resonate for Republicans. But on the other side of the aisle, you remember that Dr. King was not assassinated for his views on equal opportunity. He was assassinated during the Poor People's Campaign, where he began to engage in a politics that was very liberal, very progressive, organizing poor and working class communities across racial lines to take on the exploitative middle class and upper class establishment that wasn't providing them with a living wage, wasn't providing them with the kind of insurance benefits, wasn't providing them with the kind of support that every citizen in society deserved, according to Dr. King. And so organizing the poor and working class against the bourgeoisie and the elite is a decidedly liberal proposition, and that would put him firmly in the camp of a John Edwards, of a sort of strong leftist, strong Democrat. And so the interesting thing is that Dr. King, like most of us, and I'm sure the caller appreciates this, changed their views over a lifetime, that they're influenced by the prevailing set of social, political, and economic realities. And for Dr. King, what proved transformative to him was the introduction to nonviolence, but later his disgust with the Vietnam War and his disgust with poverty and the persistence of poverty in America, which by that time had become and firmly established itself as one of the richest civilizations on the planet.
Thanks to Eric for the call. An email from Jeff, who says, I think a conservative black is one who has, in quotes, gotten there and has lost concern for the larger cause. Comments, Professor Bracey?
Well, that's certainly, you know, an element of it. You know, in my book, in one of the later chapters, I talk about why black conservatism is attractive, what accounts for its seductiveness, not among ideologues, but for everyday folks who are trying to sort out where they are on the political spectrum. Why might they be drawn to conservative ideas? And certainly one of those attractions comes from the fact that once you have something to conserve, you invariably become more conservative. And, you know, and we noticed throughout the 80s and 90s, where blacks began to enter the middle class in larger and larger numbers, we could have predicted then that the politics of African Americans, certainly those who with increasing wealth, would begin to shift to the right. And that's right. I mean, finances have a way of shifting one's political ideology. But, you know, the interesting thing is that in the modern era, 21st century politics, we're much more issue-oriented. You know, we do issue politics, and so it's possible to be financially conservative and socially liberal now, whereas 20 years ago, that was, you know, one of these bogus propositions. Today, there are lots of leaders who claim to be financial conservatives but social liberals. And then, of course, the inverse is true, too. There are people who are socially conservative but financially liberal. I mean, mm-hmm. Mike Huckabee is an example of that. So I think that's right. I mean, one of the things that feeds into black conservatism, the attractiveness of black conservatism today, is the sense that if you've made it, if you've gotten a degree of financial security, it's easy to forget the struggle. It's easy to forget that there are other people out there who are trying to achieve the same thing, that are still facing obstacles, and it's easy to forget, yes.
Our guest is Christopher Bracey. He is a professor of law and of African and African American studies at Washington University in St. Louis. We are talking with him about his new book, Saviors or Sellouts: The Promise and Peril of Black Conservatism, from Booker T. Washington to Condoleezza Rice. We welcome your thoughts and questions on this for him. Are black conservatives saviors or sellouts? What is the promise? What is the peril of black conservatism? 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890, or send an email to talk@wpr.org. please include your first name and your community with your email. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You're listening to the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. Happy to have you along. Hope you stay tuned. Coming up, Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn. Coming up after 9 o'clock, talking about meat consumption and whether the overproduction and overconsumption of meat is harming us and the planet. That's in the next hour here on the Ideas Network. We're talking with Christopher Allen Bracey, who is the author of a book on black conservatism. It's entitled Saviors or Sellouts, 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Before we go back to the phones, Professor Bracey, what is the promise of black conservatism?
Well, I mean, I think that the promise that I speak of is the ability to take seriously the proposition as a people that you can lead a self-directed, fulfilling life. Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the promise of black conservatism. They've always said that from the beginning, that our primary aspiration is for black people to lead fulfilling, self-directed, autonomous lives,
yeah.
Not to be dependent upon anyone or anything.
And what is the peril?
The peril, of course, is that in an increasingly global society, you can't afford to be isolated and autonomous, and that if you do that, you simply may be reinforcing hostilities across or outside of your community boundaries, and that your position remains as fragile as it ever was. That, you know, the peril is that you have to be willing to engage in a progressive politics of coalition building, at a minimum, just to survive.
Yeah. So is it helpful or harmful for someone like Bill Cosby to tell the African-American community and parents in particular, hey, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps and take care of your kids and whatever else he says?
Well, you know, that's the thing. I mean, all of the sort of politics of black conservatism, I mean, one of the dominant features, and this has always been the case of black conservatives, is that they've engaged in self-critique. Right, they always claim to want to improve the lives of everyday people out of a sense of love and respect. Right, and that there's a fine line there because the comments of a Bill Cosby come off, I think, as patronizing, you know, to a lot of working class and working poor African Americans. For someone who's a multimillionaire, who has subscribed to a middle class work ethic or advances a middle class work ethic, to simply say that the solution to your problem is to take responsibility, go to school, pull your pants up, stop doing bad things, it's a bit patronizing, and it ignores, again, the prevailing set of social, political, and economic realities that contribute to the underclass and reinforce the structure of an underclass. So, you know, it's short-sighted, I think, ultimately, to simply suggest that people just take responsibility, but it's the kind of criticism that needs to be laid out there for people to hear. There needs to be a sense of urgency and desperation articulated when you look and see what's happening in the black community. You see, you know, education scores dropping among kids. You see the sort of precariousness of preparation for employment that's being done in middle and high schools, public high schools. There's a real problem that's developing, and I think that the civil rights generation sees it clearly because there has been a generational shift in the approach that young people take towards opportunity in American life. And there's a sense that maybe we're losing ground as a people. And for the younger generation to be experiencing these losses, these deficits in their youth is different than having to live with them when they become older and be strapped with them as they try to bring another generation through. And so there's a cultural divide here. There is a moment of self-critique that is necessary, but is it unqualifiedly helpful? No, there are real harms that are generated by that. The most important of which, by the way, is simply that young folks begin to tune out someone like Bill Cosby.
Mm. What about helpful or harmful for someone like Ward Connerly, who he's been to Wisconsin a couple of times speaking out against affirmative action or race-based
university admissions policies.
Yeah, I mean, my view is that we ought to be engaging in public debate on all of these questions. Mm-hmm. And so I always think it's helpful to engage in public debate. What I detest more than simple opposition to my politics is a politics of silence. Where decisions are made without public discourse. That's worse and more pernicious than someone like a Ward Connolly coming in and campaigning within your jurisdiction to gain the hearts and minds of people. But, you know, one of the interesting things is that, you know, if we, you know, and this is a crisis of democracy, right? I mean, people always forget we don't live in a pure democracy. We live in a constitutional representative democracy, and our Constitution protects individual rights of minorities against the will of the majority, encroachment of the majority, right? I mean, that's what we have by way of a Constitution. And so one of the problems when a Ward Connolly comes into your jurisdiction is that he begins to argue for a pure democracy in which the majority can and should win, right? And the majority of people may not very well support the interests of a minority population. And so, I was talking with Professor Derek Bell a couple of days ago about this very phenomenon, and he was saying, you know, why even have referenda on racial issues or divisive political questions like gay marriage, right? Why have a referendum? We know what the majority of people think. The whole point is that what we need to do is develop some way of protecting the interests of the minority or the socially disfavored against the will of the majority.
To the phones we go again. Chris in Columbus. Hi, Chris. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you, Joy, and thank you for your guest here. I absolutely enjoy his articulate position, even though I disagree a bit. I think that in my experience, and I served in the Marine Corps with a lot of people of color, and now currently work in state service with a large number of people of color. And my observation is that as people mature in their education and social lifestyle, they realize that liberalism is empty in its promises, and that by staying liberal, they keep themselves in a poorer position, both socially and economically. They realize that when you do poor people stuff, you get poor people stuff. When you do rich people stuff, you get rich people things. When you hang out with dumb people, you get dumb. When you hang out with smart people, you get smart. And when people make a break from hanging out with the guys that are teaching them how to get over on the system and start hanging out with the guys that are teaching you how to get better and improve yourself, you naturally get conservative and prosper. And that's my comment.
What's your comment, Professor Bracey?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I mean, the caller does an interesting thing. You know, what the caller is suggesting is that what is liberal is bad and retrograde, and what is conservative is good and empowering. There is a sort of, you know, seductiveness to that, sort of demonizing that which you don't agree with. But, you know, what I want to suggest, and this is what I talk about in the book, is that neither conservatives nor liberals have a monopoly on good ideas, right? Neither has the silver bullet for empowerment. If that were the case, then we'd all agree that we should be liberal or conservative. But the fact that there's been public dissension over this question for centuries suggests that neither one of these positions is the absolute correct one. The caller is correct, though. I mean, you know, age has a way of maturing people and moving them out of bad circumstances and putting them into circumstances that ultimately put them in a more productive trajectory. But I don't think that that's a conservative or a liberal move. I mean, there are many liberals who understand that the way in which you can lead a fulfilling life is by helping yourself and helping others. Whereas conservatives tend to view the sort of leading a fulfilling life as helping oneself and engaging in a rugged individualism. I think that both of those can lead someone to the same endpoint where they're happy and successful and fulfilled, but they have strikingly different impacts on society, strikingly different ideological valences. both may be highly productive for that individual. The main point, though, which I'd like to emphasize to the caller, is that, you know, we ought to be careful not to label what's liberal and progressive as necessarily retrograde culturally. I mean, equating liberal ideology with support for criminality, equating liberal ideology with support of bad behavior like drug addiction. We shouldn't indulge that, and that's not helpful at all with respect to the public discourse. I mean, if we're going to take seriously the idea of how to best empower communities, we ought to be willing to draw upon the ideas of either conservatives or liberals and anywhere in between if we care deeply about those issues.
Next, we go to Dennis in River Falls. Hi, Dennis.
Good morning. I'm curious about Professor Bracey's thoughts in terms of the general usefulness of Shelby Steele's analytical sort of framework, where he kind of divides blacks, particularly those who are or seeking to be socially or politically influential, in terms of either being bargainers or challengers. And he characterizes, of course, Obama as a bargainer, and such as Al Sharpton and Jesse Jackson as challengers. And as I understand his framework, it's that the bargainer says to the black to white society, "I'll give you the benefit of the doubt if you don't hold race against me," whereas the challenger says, "I'm assuming you're racist unless and until you prove to me you're not." Yeah, this is the framework he sets out most, you know, in this recent book on Obama, A Bound Man.
Right, that's correct. And, you know, what do I think about that? I mean, you know, that's a sort of interesting idea. I mean, when Shelby Steele released that book, we were all wondering, what's the purpose of this, right? What is he trying to do? Is he trying to help Barack? Is he trying to hurt Barack? Is he trying to deepen public discourse on what kind of leaders are good for black people? We didn't quite know what to make of it. I think that his distinction is correct, that, you know, there always have been leaders that have sought to brush institutions of society against the grain, right? And they have typically been our liberal leaders. And this is across the color line, right? This is not a black-white issue or a race issue in particular. And there have always been bargainers, as Shelby Steele puts it, right? People who are willing to sit down at the table and hammer out political compromises in which neither side is fully satisfied, but both sides or all sides feel as though they've gotten something out of it. And what I take from what Professor Steele is talking about is that he believes on some level that bargaining can be problematic, but he also thinks that bargaining allows for greater possibilities of transactions. And the people like a Jesse Jackson or Sharpton who want to brush the institutions of society against the challengers, these are the ones who can engage and hold up politics, shake down politics. They can extract concessions, but they do it at the expense of principle. And it's unclear where that takes us. My view, and you know, I tend to be very ecumenical about this, is that we should be looking to have leaders of all stripes, whether they be bargainers or challengers, out there doing their best to represent their respective constituencies. And for Barack Obama in particular, he's looking to transcend race. He wants to be able to represent a nation of people who are unified behind an idea or a symbol of hope and optimism. And so for him, he can't challenge. He has to be a bargainer. There's no option there for him. For someone like a Sharpton or someone like a Jesse Jackson who define their constituency quite narrowly, they draw traction from brushing institutions against the grain, right? That's where their strength lies, in being oppositional, right? And so they're, in a sense, you can imagine that both Barack Obama and our traditional civil rights leaders are engaging in a politics of necessity. They have to do it because these are the positions they've staked out for themselves.
Thanks, Dennis. Tim in Madison joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Hi. My comment is this. I think, this is my opinion, black conservatism really stems from two very disparate elements of basic social conservatism, one of which was mentioned was the Christian evangelical. I venture to guess from my perspective that most black churches are fundamentalist and conservative theologically, thereby going over to the conservative side politically. But the other side of the coin is the prison/street/gang culture, of which all is under the umbrella of hip-hop culture, which, again, is almost the polar opposite of Christian evangelical, yet that culture is very anti-gay, anti-female, and very naturally, I think, conservative. And just case in point, locally, we had a same anti-gay marriage amendment here in Wisconsin, and of which it was also against any type of civil union or anything substantially similar, which basically was outlawing male-female cohabitation, a legal status for that anyway. And a majority of African-Americans, in my experience and perspective, are unmarried couples. And yet there was no African-American movement against, you know, that particular amendment for that reason, but the opposite, more, I think, you know, voting in favor of this, the same-sex marriage ban, which has been, and a civil union ban that's written into our Constitution. So just the other dynamics of that social conservatism affecting the political conservatism, particularly that hip-hop culture and the Christian evangelical fundamentalist culture.
Professor Bracey?
Yeah, well, the caller makes an interesting point here, which is that, you know, we can't forget, you know, sort of popular culture as influencing politics. And I think the caller's right. There's a dialectic here. This is not, you know, black conservatism isn't necessarily a top-down movement. Mm-hmm. In fact, it's been precisely the opposite, you know, at least up until 1980. It was a bottom-up politics, right, that is sourced from the experiences, the lived experiences of community members. And so you find that there is a latent social conservatism that is sourced from the Christian evangelical tradition. But, you know, something that we don't like to talk about within the black community, certainly among black progressives, is this sort of traditional, longstanding hostility towards gay rights and opposition to homosexuality. That's also something that exists within the Latino community, you know, and that's soon to develop and be explored and critiqued as well. But, you know, I wouldn't read too deeply into that. I mean, you know, what's interesting is that there's a convergence among the intellectual elite. There's always been the suspicion of the gay rights movement co-opting the civil rights tradition to extract political gains and concessions for gays. That sort of the traditional civil rights establishment covet. I mean, they covet that history. They don't want that history co-opted and used or abused by any other movement, that it's sort of, you know, unique to the African-American experience. And so they're very hesitant to allow gays to make that analogy without critique. That's at the intellectual level. At the grassroots level, there's always been hostility towards gays and homosexuality and misogyny among black folks at the grassroots level. I wouldn't overstate that point, though. That's the only comment that I would add to the caller. Yeah. To the caller, I wouldn't overstate that. I mean, whatever you might think about African American culture, hip hop doesn't define it.
I'm afraid that we're out of time, so we'll have to leave it on that note. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Christopher Bracey, professor of law and of African and African American studies at Washington University, author of the book Saviors or Sellouts, about black conservatism. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.